This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the Friday Sporting Edition of Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewerts, and today, what a difference a year makes as the countdown to the Pacific Games in Honiara continues. Solomon Islands National Institute of Sports is blossoming.
400 to 450 athletes per day come through CINNIS. We have about 1,200 athletes on scholarship. We work across 25 different sports. We work with about 100 coaches on a weekly basis.
Fiji's national head coach in confident mood as the Baby Buller boys go in search of a place at the Under-17 FIFA World Cup.
Our Under-19 has already qualified for the Under-20 World Cup this year in Indonesia. And if we could qualify also for the Under-17 World Cup, it would be a boost for football in the country in general.
And time is of the essence in rugby union. Manu Samoa's head coach gives us his verdict on the new rules designed to speed up the 15-a-side game.
Teams will look to ways to push the boundaries, as we always do. I think there'll be some teething issues at the start, but I think once everyone kind of gets into the flow of things and then gets used to it, I don't see it being too much of an issue.
More to come from Selala Mapasua on World Rugby's time-saving rule changes later in the programme. But we start this morning with the political situation in Fiji, where Deputy Prime Minister Viliame Navoka has assured the people that the new administration is determined to work together. Previous coalition governments in Fiji have not done well, but Mr. Navoka has promised that history will not repeat itself. He says things are different this time because all three parties were critical of the Fiji First Administration and wanted change. Meanwhile, the new government has fired back at further claims from former Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama about unrest in the country and allegations that the Rambuka administration is acting unconstitutionally. Our reporter in Fiji, Lithe Mavono, is following developments. She joins us on the line from Suva. Lithe, good morning to you. Hi, Lithe, can you hear me?
Yanda, Richard, I'm sorry about that. Yes, I can hear you. Good morning.
All good to go. And tell me, what is the latest thrust of Frank Bainimarama's threats and accusations against the Rambuka government? He's come out and made a couple of fairly fiery statements over the recent days. What is he getting at exactly?
Well, he's accusing the new government, the coalition government, of messing with the 2013 constitution, accusing them of not following the provisions in the constitutions, particularly as the new government looks around to people who were loyal to the Fiji First government and offering them a way out. And so the former Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama is alleging that the situation in Fiji is dire and that people are frightened and people no longer, believe in the new administration and are calling on people to come directly to the opposition if they feel they're being unfairly treated. He's calling himself some sort of facilitator, is, I think, the word he used, a facilitator of the 2013 constitution, a protector of sorts. So it's a little bit of a veiled threat, Richard.
So we've had a response now from government, in particular from the Home Affairs Minister, Pio Tikua Ndur. I mean, what he seems to have been saying is that there's nothing to see here. We're just getting on with the job.
That's exactly what he's saying, Richard. And in fact, that is what the situation looks like on the ground, particularly from Pio Tikua Ndur's ministry, which looks after both the military and the police. And so we see the police, going around celebrating New Year's with people. And so Tikua Ndur is also calling on public servants, particularly, to reach out to them or to reach out to independent institutions if they feel aggrieved or if they feel that they're victims of a witch hunt of some sort. And so he's made a bit of a reassurance, telling people that they intend to not remove anyone and to give people the opportunity to leave if they want to, and to do that within the provisions of the 2013 Constitution, Richard.
And on the general state of affairs in the country, that the minister stepped up to the microphone yesterday at a media conference, and this is how he put it.
Let me begin by assuring all members of the public on behalf of the Prime Minister and the government that besides the ongoing work that the police do in the ordinary course of their duties, the general law and order situation in Fiji is as normal. Now, I believe that our democracy and the rule of law is paramount. Any threats to that will be dealt with swiftly and with the full force of Fiji's law enforcement agencies.
So that's the response from government. Pretty clear, pretty unequivocal. What about the response from community organisations? Is there any concern within that sector?
Yes, Richard. The Fiji Council of Social Services, which has 18 offices around the country and about 400 plus affiliated members, are calling on Frank Bainimarama and the opposition leaders to restrain themselves. Basically, they're saying that the sort of comments made recently by Bainimarama is tantamount to inciting violence and used what they're calling early warning signs of atrocities to look at what is being said recently, and saying that there are lots of people who could resort to violence if narratives such as the one said recently by Bainimarama continues.
And I suppose the other undercurrent, which is almost ever present in Fiji at a time like this, is where the military stand on the situation. Now, Minister Tiku Ndua-Ndua has been talking to the military commander, and I think he's got a pretty positive response from him.
That's right. He said that the commander invited him up to the Queen Elizabeth Barracks, the base of the military in Fiji, and had what he described as a pleasant and peaceful conversation about the situation, and a reassurance from the commander, Chone Kaloniwai, that the military intends to stay well out of the political process and to let the democratic process run its course.
Now, one of the things that the minister asked in the early days of the administration was that those military who had been involved on security detail within the civil service should basically go back to just being soldiers, and it appears he's got that reassurance. Here's the minister again.
I met with the commander of the RFMF, Major General Chone Kaloniwai. Our meeting was pleasant, and the commander has assured me that he shares the government's vision for a peaceful, prosperous and secure Fiji for all. In addition, he has briefed me on the status of the demilitarization of the civil service, and he has assured me that all soldiers employed in the civil service have returned to barracks.
We're also led to believe that all arms that were being used for personal protection of the former Prime Minister, ministers, the Chief Justice, they're all accounted for, all back in the armory now. So it sounds very much as though the military are on the same page as the opposition. Is that the general feeling within the community? Are people feeling comfortable, shall we say, if I can put it that way?
People definitely are feeling comfortable, Richard. And that change, the callback of soldiers to the camp, has been quite visible. One of the biggest ways in which you saw the militarization of society was that there were soldiers always accompanying ministers. That is now gone. We don't see ministers accompanied by bodyguards, except for the usual police close protection units, which is something that we last saw close to 20 years ago now. That change happened almost immediately last week, and so we saw it on the streets. There are no more entourages of security vehicles manned by military. Those have all gone back to the camps and to the different military bases. So it's quite visible. And in fact, we're seeing more police presence on the streets. We're seeing, police public relations initiatives where they're going out still now in the coming days. They're visiting neighborhoods all across the country using their band, which is sort of almost like a public initiative of sort to tell people we're back and things are okay. And there's dancing on the streets with police officers, something we have not seen in very many years, Richard.
No, that in itself is pretty extraordinary. One other question, if I may. Isai Kayum, is he still an MP or is he not an MP? Is he coming back to Fiji? I mean, what's the speculation?
That's a very good question, because it's quite a complex one. He is no longer an MP. He is no longer a member of the Constitutional Officers Commission. He is also, as far as we understand it, he's also no longer the General Secretary of the Fiji First Party, because when he accepted the COC appointment, he vacated his seat. And so he can only be reappointed to the position in an annual general meeting, and which is yet to happen. So he currently does not have a place in the Fiji First Party Executive Committee. He's no longer a Member of Parliament, not in the COC, and he's not in the country, Richard. He's there in Australia.
Yes, I believe last spotted at a shopping centre, Parramatta, in Sydney, according to all the gossip on social media. It's the story that keeps on giving, isn't it? Lily, thank you so much for the update. It's a fascinating situation in Fiji. We'll no doubt touch base with you again very soon.
Vinaka.
Lily Mavona there, our reporter in Fiji, with the continuing aftermath after the coalition government took charge, what, just 2 weeks ago now? And it's an eventful day every day in Fiji just at the moment. Pacific Beat. You're with Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. It's the Friday morning sporting edition, and a year after it opened its doors for the first time, the executive director of CINIS, Solomon Islands National Institute of Sport, says the impact on the country's sporting landscape has been immense. Aaron Alsop says there has been a surge of interest in many sports, and the Solomons medal prospects when they host the Pacific Games in Honiara in November are looking very bright. It's familiar territory for Alsop, who presided over the birth of a similar high-performance setup in Papua New Guinea and led the team to a record haul of 88 gold medals at the 2015 Pacific Games in Port Moresby. He says the aim of CINIS is to provide a platform for talented athletes to develop in-country without the need to travel overseas to train, and that strategy, he says, is paying big dividends.
There was a lot of initial scepticism, I think, because it's such a significant change to the way the system's been run in the Pacific and in general in terms of what high performance really looks like. So to have a year of operation where now we average 400 to 450 athletes per day come through CINIS. We have about 1,200 athletes on scholarship. We work across 25 different sports. We work with about 100 coaches on a weekly basis. So considering a year ago we didn't have that happening, we're really happy with how things are progressing.
Are there particular sports that have sprung to life, as it were, over the last year, and a talent pool that maybe people weren't too aware of is beginning to get the support that it needs to develop?
It's really hard for people to imagine what it's like running a national high-performance program without a facility to train in, but that's been the common theme in the Solomons for a long time. So the Solomon Islands National Institute of Sport provides a daily training environment for 21 of the 25 sports in terms of a sport-specific training facility. So just the fact that they've got a facility and equipment, and it's a safe, clean environment for them to be able to come and train on a daily basis, the provision of then high-performance services to those sports in terms of strength and conditioning, sports science, nutrition, mental skills, physiotherapy. Those sports have never had access to this before. So we're seeing not just one or two, but, you know, across the group, there's, you know, 15-odd sports now that are really thriving and flourishing in terms of athlete growth in numbers, quality of training, performances. So it's been really encouraging to see that development over the last 12 months.
So if we wind the clock back a few years to the Pacific Games in Papua New Guinea, and you set up the high-performance unit there and had extraordinary success in terms of the number of medals that were won by PNG athletes that year, can you see similarities? Could you see Solomon Islands topping the medal table?
I don't know necessarily that topping the medal tally is directly the initial goal. I think what we are confident of is definitely having the best medal performance we've ever had in history. You know, humbly, I think the growth that we're seeing in the quality of training and the quality of the athletes and coaches indicates that we're definitely on track to produce results across more sports than we've ever had before, and definitely, I think, improved results across all of those sports. There's no doubt in our mind that that will happen. What we are seeing in terms of similarities is the change system that needs to happen, the typical changes in the way that we see the learning, the new concepts, the interest in understanding what high performance actually is, those patterns are very similar to what we experienced in PNG. One of the differences, I think, in PNG is that they have a very mature sport system. They understand sport. And one of the things that Solomons is really growing in now is embracing a lot of these high-performance concepts, which is why we're seeing such a dramatic shift in the last 12 months.
It's been talked about in the past, and I particularly recall talking about it when you were in PNG, about an Oceania high-performance setup. But up to press, that hasn't quite come to fruition. But allowing for what's happening in Solomons, allowing for the success that you had in PNG and what else is happening around the Pacific, do you think we might get that set up one day?
Oh, I think it's essential. Having spent time in Vanuatu, Samoa, Fiji, we work with colleagues in different parts of Micronesia. We do work with people who are based out of Tonga. It's essential, I think, for the region that we do set up something around an Oceania high-performance concept. Too many times we see athletes taken away from their families, moved overseas to an environment they're not as familiar with. The weather's very different. The culture's very different. And if we can keep the athletes within the Pacific, we keep them around familiar surroundings, we keep them closer to their family, they get to practice their cultural and spiritual beliefs. We can bring the high-performance expertise into the region and we help develop local high-performance expertise, which ultimately produces more sustainable results in the future. That, I think, is the model moving forward. You know, we know there's an incredible amount of money spent in the Pacific from Oceania federations as well as Olympic solidarity scholarships for athletes to travel and train overseas. We've been able to prove that you can get the results training at home if you develop the right systems around those athletes and then just send them overseas for competition opportunities. So I think ultimately to create a more sustainable high-performance system in the Pacific, an Oceania Sports Institute would make sense. I think there's justification for it financially as well as human resource-wise. But ultimately that comes to an aligned strategy across the Oceania region, which is what we're starting to do now through some Oceania leaders, as well as also the Oceania federations that run the different sports.
So would the establishment of such an institute be a big step towards something else that's been talked about often over the years, which is an Oceania Games rather than a Pacific Games? It would feature Australia and New Zealand competing against the Pacific Islands, essentially on level terms, whereas at the moment they only compete in certain sports and it's geared, as it were, to give the Pacific Islands a bit of a chance, shall we say. I hope that doesn't sound patronising, but I think that's the way it works.
Yeah, look, I think the concept around the Oceania Continental Games is inevitable. That will have to happen at some stage regardless, because the way that the structure of qualification through to the Olympics and other international games is based on that. So I think that will naturally evolve. I know the Pacific Games Council has done a tremendous amount of work to get more Pacific Games sports to become the pathway to Olympic qualification, which is why we see Australia and New Zealand compete in those competitions. The concept around the Oceania Sports Institute is really to provide the ultimate support that they need within their own daily training environment that they don't have at the moment. Doesn't necessarily mean we're going to be competitive at the same level, purely because you look at some countries in terms of investment and their population. Those factors do make it challenging to be effective at a high performance level across so many sports. But I think in targeted sports, we've already seen success in a few individual sports that have proven that domestic-based programs can produce international results. And if we play more competitive opportunities, then the athletes are aware of the standards that they're working towards. And I think ultimately that we'll see that happen over the next 5 to 10 years.
Executive Director Aaron Allsop reflecting on what was achieved during year one at Solomon Islands National Institute of Sport and what the future structure of high performance sport in the Pacific might look like. Pacific Beat. Next this morning, the OFC Under-17 Men's Championship kicks off in Fiji next week, and the host nation may never have a better chance to secure a place at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Peru at the end of the year. The two finalists at the regional tournament will qualify automatically, and while New Zealand will start as perennial favourites to win the OFC title, Fiji look well placed to join them in the decider. Solomon Islands, who went to the World Cup in Brazil after finishing runners-up to New Zealand in 2018, are banned this time over player eligibility breaches that emerged post-competition. And now Papua New Guinea will also be missing after they inexplicably failed to register their team on time. So with those two big guns absent and the baby Buller boys having home advantage, national coach Fleming Seretslev is quietly confident, although he says that wasn't the case a few months ago.
Actually, after having a rather weak start, we were very concerned about our 16. But having worked with them now for more than 2 months, we are actually rather optimistic.
And I think four of the squad are from overseas. I think three are New Zealand-based and one based in Australia. I mean, what was that a deliberate ploy to look for Fijians outside the country?
Yep, we have had trials where we also announced in New Zealand or Australia that we would have trials here in Fiji. So before we started our camping, we had those trials, and we have some good overseas players.
And the format of this tournament is somewhat unusual. I mean, there are 10 teams taking part, of which 8 will go through to the quarterfinals. So, in essence, you've got to play pretty badly to at least not make the knockout stage.
Yeah, you're totally right. It would be really a disaster if we can't qualify for the quarterfinals. And now there are only 9 teams because PNG has been withdrawn.
Therefore, if there are only 9 teams left, then clearly only one is going to miss out on the quarterfinals. So I think it's fair to assume that Fiji will be amongst that group of 8. And of course, the carrot here, the enticement here, is automatic qualification for the Under-17 World Cup. If you make the final, you go to the World Cup in Peru.
Yeah, exactly.
How much of a boost do you think that would be for the development of football in Fiji overall? Because it's something that Solomon Islands have done, who again are not there this time because of the problems they had with passports last time. And also New Caledonia have played in the World Cup. I mean, it's a huge opportunity, isn't it, for young players?
It's really, our Under-19 has already qualified for the Under-20 World Cup this year in Indonesia, which is a huge achievement. And if we could qualify also for the Under-17 World Cup, it would be a huge achievement for Fiji football and a boost, I would say, for football in the country in general.
And tell me a little bit about your role working with the age group teams. Are you, as it were, in overall charge, but not necessarily coaching on the day? How does it work?
It has actually, for me, it has been a very busy year because I've been involved in the Women's Nations Cup and also for a four-nation trip in Australia with the women where I was the head coach. I've been working a lot with the Under-19 before they left for Tahiti. I followed them during a camp in New Zealand. So I've been involved there, and from here from the Under-16, I've been more or less involved from day one. I'm not the head coach. Sunil Kumar is our head coach, but we are having a coaching panel, and we are working very close together.
How would you say things have changed then in the way that the game is being run in Fiji at international level since you arrived in the country? Because, of course, your predecessor, Christophe Camel, came from France and came with a good track record. I mean, have you had to change much of what he did or build on what he did?
What I did when I came here was to try to implement a new playing style philosophy. And this playing style philosophy we have actually used as well for our women's team as for our Under-19, of course, for our national team, but we are also using it here for the Under-16. So I believe it's the biggest impact I have had from my side that we now have, you could say, a clear Fijian playing style.
And the biggest carrot of all now, of course, would be World Cup qualification for the senior men's team in 2026, with now 1 1/3 places available to teams from OFC.
It's for sure the target for Fiji football, no doubt about this. Before the World Cup qualifiers last year, we have actually started already now preparing for 2026 in the way that we lined up a very young squad in Qatar for our qualifiers. And 2026, most of them will be in their best football age at that time.
And if Fiji is in the mix, or if indeed they do manage to qualify for the 2026 World Cup, Roy Krishna, would he still feature? Do you think he'll be not far short of 40 by then?
I think he'll be 38, Roy. And I have to say, as he looks right now and as he played for us in 2022, he's really in a good shape. He has this professional attitude. He's in a professional environment that is taking care of everything around the individual player. He's really a professional himself, taking very well care of himself with sleep, with nutrition, with everything. He manages his body and his mind in an extremely good way. And if he avoids tougher injuries, I'm rather sure he can play in 2026.
And were that to happen, it would be 10 years after Roy Krishna played for Fiji at the Rio Olympics and scored his country's solitary goal in the match against Mexico. Former Danish international Flemming Saratslev there, Fiji's national head soccer coach right now. But his contract is due to expire at the end of the month, so we must wait and see if the Fiji FA opts to keep him on or not. And the opening match for Fiji in the OFC Under-17 tournament, that'll be against Samoa next Thursday. The tournament itself kicks off on Wednesday with New Zealand playing New Caledonia and Tahiti taking on Vanuatu. Holding the front page myself this morning as we take a look at one or two of the stories making news around the region at this point of Pacific Beat. And more problems, I'm afraid, for Air New Guinea, with the airline's fuel supplier Puma Energy suspending deliveries of A1 jet fuel, apparently due to issues with accessing US dollars. The suspension will affect Port Moresby and all airports around PNG, with all domestic flights currently cancelled and set to continue, Air New Guinea says, until Puma lifts its restrictions. The airline insists it is up to date with all its payments to Puma and that the situation is entirely out of their control. Officials say they will continue to work with all concerned in order to ensure that normal operations can resume as quickly as possible. Meantime, though, it would appear there's a bit of a travel standstill in PNG. Now, the Pacific Islands Forum has reaffirmed its condemnation of Japan's proposal to dump treated radioactive wastewater into the Pacific from storage tanks at the stricken Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Writing in Islands Business, Director General Henry Puna says the forum wants a delay in proposed dumping. He says the decision for any ocean release is not and should not only be a domestic matter for Japan, but a global and transnational matter that should give rise to the need to examine the issue in the context, he says, of obligations under international law. Mr. Puna adds that we, the forum, have uncovered serious information gaps and grave concerns with the proposed ocean release. And more data is needed, he says, before any ocean release should be permitted. And back on the sporting front, cricket Vanuatu are on the hunt for a new head of high performance and head coach after Ben Cameron resigned from the dual role after just 8 months for family reasons. After a difficult start because of COVID restrictions that prevented him from entering the country, Cameron led Vanuatu to victory in the ICC Men's T20 World Cup Pacific qualifier in Port Vila back in September. Assistant coach and former national player Eddie Bansali is also stepping down from his role to take up a post in the Vanuatu government. Cricket Vanuatu will be looking for sure to find replacements as soon as possible, with a range of tournaments coming up this year, including the ICC Men's T20 World Cup East Asia Pacific Regional Final coming up in July, and whoever wins that will go to the next T20 World Cup.
We need to be prepared for the future.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your home or your life isn't.
Cyclone after cyclone, every natural disaster gets worse.
Learn what to do before, during, and after natural disasters in this program aimed at keeping you safe.
I'm a survivor.
Pacific Prepared, Fridays at 8:30 a.m. PNG time here on ABC Radio Australia.
And you're with Pacific Beat for a Friday morning. My name is Richard Hewitt. It's the Friday Sporting Edition. And when it comes to playing 15-a-side rugby from now on, time is very much of the essence, it would seem. A set of new rules introduced by World Rugby on January 1st will demand that key moments in games play out without unnecessary delay. So in future, conversions and penalties and scrum and line-out formation will all be on the clock. And if either side fails to keep to time limits, they will concede a free kick. There'll also be a crackdown on time wasting. So at the start of what is a World Cup year for the men, coaches will need to ensure that their players are up to speed when the big games come around. I've been talking to Manu Samoa's head coach, Silala Mapasua, to get his view on the new regulations. And he's hoping common sense will prevail so that gamesmanship is reduced, but with no loss of competitiveness.
Players and coaches alike will have to adapt pretty quickly. As with most rule changes, especially in recent times, looking to speed of the game is making the game a better spectacle and growing the game in that sense. Teams will look looked away is to push the boundaries, as we always do. I think there'll be some teething issues at the start, but I think once everyone kind of gets into the flow of things and then gets used to it, I don't see it being too much of an issue.
When it comes to preparing particularly for the World Cup later this year, your training sessions now with the Manu, certainly I would assume in the early part of the year, are you going to have somebody monitoring this and keeping a close eye on how long things take to happen?
Oh, absolutely. There's so much data available in the games now, and I know we'll be looking to draw out the data that's relevant to how we want to play, and then also the opposition we're coming up against. Definitely keeping a close eye on how our teams in our pool will be looking to play the game with the amendments to the laws. So I think our analysts will have a lot of work to do.
People, I imagine, who look at the way that Pacific Islands teams play rugby will say speeding the game up is probably a bit of an advantage for yourselves, for Fiji, for Tonga, because you like to play quick rugby.
We do. We do like to play a hard, fast game. That's our profile, and one of our strengths is when the ball is in play. Conditioning becomes a big part of it, and making sure that we are able to sustain the way we want to play for long periods. I imagine the time of ball in play, especially test matches now, will be trying kind of getting up to that 40 to 45 minute mark. So I think we'll enjoy it, and it also gives me a chance to send a clear message to players around where they need to be at in order to really compete internationally now.
Could there be a potential downside to these rule changes? I'm thinking in particular of what is now Law 19.4, the scrum. It says teams must be ready to form the scrum within 30 seconds of the mark being made. The sanction, if they fail to do that, is a free kick awarded against them. But World Rugby has worked for years to make the scrum safe. Surely anything that's designed to speed that process up is counterproductive, isn't it?
Yeah, it is an area of concern, and I think as long as there's sufficient time within reason that we can make sure that players have gone through their processes to get themselves into the safest position possible before the engagement of a scrum, I think that needs to be at the forefront of referees' minds. And as you said, if we're rushing that process and it becomes unsafe, that's where the issues will be. For the last kind of 5 to 10 years, especially, you see forwards going through their processes and making sure that they're technically in the safest position, and also to be able to compete, because it is the game within the game, and it can be a big difference in the outcome of a game. So as long as we're not putting anyone at risk, I think speeding that process up is the tricky area, and there has to be a little bit of give and take there from referees and the lawmakers to make sure that our player safety is at the forefront.
It would seem to me that most of the new rules are easy enough for a referee to manage, because there is very specifically about the time that it takes for something to happen in a game. But the one I see as potentially being controversial is the time-wasting rule, because surely referees here are being asked to read players' minds, aren't they? They're going to have to decide whether a player is deliberately wasting time, and that's a pretty hard thing to do.
I'm still a bit unclear on that one, on what that looks like, and now that there's a bit of gamesmanship in there as well, that players, as they've always done, will push the laws as far as they can. So I think as long as it doesn't ruin the game, if that makes sense, if we're not just giving up free kicks for the sake of sticking to the letter of the law, I think there has to be a little bit of give and take. And at the same time, players need to be made aware that what constitutes time wasting. So as long as we're clear on that and players have absolute clarity, then there shouldn't be any complaints.
We'll see. Cap 26 times for his country, 7 times for the combined Pacific Islands team. That's Manu Samoa's head coach, Salala Mapasua, on the line from Apia. And the first test for the Manu under those new rules won't in fact be until July in the Pacific Nations Cup. And after that, it'll be on to the World Cup in France in September, when Samoa will line up against England, Japan, Argentina and Chile in Pool D.
Pacific Beat.
Now, it's 15 minutes to go on Pacific Beat's Friday morning sporting edition, and time to talk through some of the sporting issues of the week with our regular contributor, sports writer and social media forum moderator, Tia Rocco. Welcome, Tia. Good morning and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Richard. A big bula vinaka from the island of Milangimbi in northeast Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory. This is the homeland of the famous Baker Boy who, as you know, took out some music awards, Australian Music Awards in 2022, Richard.
He did, and I believe he will be performing at Marvel Stadium here in Melbourne, not tomorrow, but Saturday week, in the break between innings when Melbourne Stars and Melbourne Renegades take each other on in the Big Bash Cricket League. So, yeah, so there you go. Now, we're going to talk rugby union, first of all, and we've talked once or twice in the past about who's going to be coaching the Fijiana Undrua and the national team in 2023. We now know that Seni Saravakula has resigned from that post, but he's still on the payroll at the FRU. This is a curious state of affairs, isn't it?
Yes, most certainly, Richard. Well, you and I have been talking about this since the end of the Women's Rugby World Cup last year. We've talked about the facts of the matter and bringing things out in the open with what was happening in the Fijiana camp. And if you will remember last year when I went to visit the team prior to the World Cup journey, we furthermore unpacked all the layers of what was really going on with this team, Richard, surrounding allegations and speculations regarding bullying and the mistreatment of players, and we then heard about possible investigations by World Rugby. So it's most unfortunate that this has ended in the stepping down of the unbeaten Super W coach. Not a good introduction into the new year, Richard. And prior to the news breaking across all media channels, Pacific Beat was aware of Inoke Male and Mike Legg, both assistant coaches for the Fijian and Drua last season, are now looking after the team until the new head coach is appointed, and that position, we are told, is going to be advertised. Seni is understandably, Richard, one of the greatest local produce coaches from the Pacific, and Richard, I dare say that his next appointment in Fiji rugby is going to be a step up, and no doubt, if the allegations are correct, he will most certainly be performance managed and further scrutinised around, in particular, his governance. So not a good start to the year, as I said, for Fijiana, but it's also good to know so that the team can get cracking for the preparation for the 2023 Super W, Richard, and we're all looking forward to watching that, no doubt.
Yes, it's going to be interesting to see who gets the coaching job. I spoke to Inoke Male earlier in the week before the official news of the resignation, and his response was he didn't know what was going on. So whether he was keeping his cards close to his chest or not, I guess time will tell. Now, what about the Fijiana Sevens team? Because there's some speculation around the coaching setup there too. I mean, could there be more changes?
With the Fijiana Sevens coach in particular, there's been some murmurings from sources, Richard, regarding the performance and coaching of the team. But I think we can say that Saisi Fuli has been the maestro of turning this team around since well before COVID. But slowly and surely, this team is always having a crack at things each tournament they play as they keep sharpening and refining their tools. And we all know Richard Saisi is an amazing coach, almost like a father figure to the Fijiana Sevens team. And when we watched him in action with the side, especially whilst training in Suva, it was so good to see, you know, in particular his care around the team. It's also good to know that Saisi is being paid a salary almost, but not quite the same as overseas coaches, but certainly a step in the right direction for this experienced women's coach. Yeah, so there's been some murmurings on that end, but not confirmed yet, Richard.
And what about the murmurings within the Fiji men's sevens camp? Been a few stories coming out of the media in Fiji suggesting all is not well. Perhaps Ben Gollings as head coach is taking a bit of a back seat, maybe with the intention of bringing local coaches to the fore. Do you have a handle on what's really going on there?
Yes, okay. This week, Richard, we heard that Gollings will be giving a lot of the team responsibility to Satala, his assistant local coach. And the good news is that Jerry Tuai will be the understudy. Look, Jerry Tuai is very much needed when it comes to this Sevens Fijian team. In my opinion, Jerry and Kalini Sao combo would have been great. But, you know, that would be in the ideal world, Richard. So most certainly a bit of reshuffling happening on that that end with people, of course, and still, you know, people are still questioning Etu the Samoan, who's an Australian-based trainer who was controversially brought in by Goelings, with people questioning his relevance on the Fiji national side. But perhaps that's another story for another day, Richard.
And question without notice, but now we have a new government in place. Is that by extension going to make life easier for somebody like Ben Goelings? Because in theory, they're not going to have people breathing down their necks. That has surely been the case for you know, foreign coaches coming in over the last few years.
Yes, you remember Ben Ryan documented how the government interfered a lot with Sevens in the country. So hopefully this will be better times for international coaches coming in. No doubt we will have to be watching that and scrutinising that in the next couple of months, Richard.
I suppose it helps to have a Prime Minister who played for the Flying Fijians, perhaps, instead of any Rumbuka. Now, moving on to soccer, Vanuatu's national captain, Brian Kaltak, I mean, he had to wait a long time to get his first professional contract with the Central Coast Mariners in the A-League. He started that contract at the ripe old age for a soccer player of 28, but he's having a stellar first season. He's played every game bar one, which he had to miss because he got a red card. Seems to be playing out of his skin. The team are doing extremely well. I mean, this is a perfect advertisement, isn't it, for Pacific soccer talent?
Most certainly, Richard. I'm so excited for Brian. I mean, what an amazing journey this 29-year-old is having in the A-League, Richard. He is considered to be a very powerful athlete, who continues to grow from strength to strength. And Brian, as we all know, came to the Mariners as a trialist when the club was looking to fill the void left by the departure of Socceroos centre back Kyle Rowles to the Scottish side Hearts. But news reports say that Kaltak looks to be ready-made replacement, and he was rock solid for the Mariners in their 3-0 win over Newcastle on Wednesday. Richard, well done to Brian, and may he continue to grow from strength to strength in 2023. Looking forward to watching him in action, Richard.
And I believe from a conversation I was having yesterday with the Fiji national coach, Fleming Seretslev, that there is a Fijian player waiting in the wings there at Central Coast Mariners by the name of Dan Hall. He has Fijian heritage on his mother's side, I believe. And he was playing for Central Coast Mariners, but seems to have been pushed out a bit by the arrival of Brian Kaltak. But potentially that there's another Pacific player who could make an impact. Because what I'm thinking now is that Brian Kaltak has set the benchmark, and maybe finally clubs here in Australia will go, yeah, there is talent in the Pacific, we're going to look for more.
Yes, it's great to know that athletes like Brian are certainly opening doors for the gaze to be directed towards the Pacific in terms of soccer. So, yeah, it should be an interesting year ahead to see what's happening there.
Final point, $1.2 million, I'm told, it cost to take 9 of the Toa Samoa players who reached the Rugby League World Cup final to Apia to be welcomed there by the fans, who are clearly crazy about the whole thing, and why wouldn't they be? And there was a parade through the streets, and I believe they made a visit to a church as well, but they didn't do too much else. I'm not sure whether $1.2 million is value for money there. Wouldn't it have been better spent on developing the sport?
Yes, a very interesting story that has a lot of people baffled, Richard. So on the 27th of December, Newsline Samoa reported that the Samoan Rugby League president and his management were knocking at homes outside Samoa to fundraise through a radiothon to meet their costs. So far at that stage, they'd collected 227,000 tala from the 260,000 tala that came from radiothon pledges, and they were still going hard to call out for public support. Now, the as we all know, Samoa International Business Finance Centre also donated $500,000 tala as the main sponsor of the Toa Samoa. Look, you know, it's an event that has everyone baffled. Certainly, some would call extreme efforts, taking great lengths to achieve a massive goal by the Samoan Rugby League, but rather unfortunate that only nine players turned up. So, yeah, it's a kind of story that makes one wonder. But kudos to the organisers for achieving their goals. And we see that everyone certainly had a great time, a memorable occasion indeed for the country, and really certainly interested to see the future of rugby league and sevens for this country, Richard.
Yeah, I think personally it would have been nice to see the NRL, who, let's face it, effectively run the sport worldwide, put their hands in their pockets and contribute to what was an historic occasion for Toa Samoa, because I think they could have done that quite easily rather than putting the NRL in Samoa into what I suspect is quite an awkward financial position now.
Yes, most certainly. Not sure what was happening there, Richard, but no doubt the locals have taken the event into their hands and made it quite a spectacular event.
Well, it was, and it was certainly worthy of celebration, and the fact that they made it to the Rugby League World Cup final, well, that's in the history books now, isn't it? And fingers crossed that at the next World Cup, Samoa or Tonga or Fiji or one of the Pacific nations might actually win the thing, which would be rather nice. Dear, thank you so much for joining us for the first time in 2023. We look forward to many more conversations and many more sporting insights throughout the year.
Yes, looking forward to more stories from the Pacific sports, especially, Richard.
Pacific Beat.
Friday morning, Pacific Beat, the sporting program, and we're at an end now. We will be back at various times over the weekend with Pacific Review, taking a look back at some of the stories making headlines over the last 7 days. The afternoon edition of Pacific Beat at 3:05 PNG time this afternoon, and then we're back on Monday morning, 6:05 PNG time. And it will be Kyle Evans in the chair for the first time. So good luck to him. I'm Richard Ewart. Thanks for your company. Have a great sporting weekend.